From South Carolina Public Radio, this is the South Carolina Lead. I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode was recorded on October 4th, 2024, from South Carolina Public Radio Studios here in Columbia. Not the side of a road, folks. This week, we're looking at the response and recovery efforts in South Carolina to Tropical Storm Helene, which rolled through the state early last Friday, causing more than 41 deaths, damaging over 3,500 homes, and plunging 1.3 million residents into darkness, which, as of our taping, still includes 270,000 outages. The Lead loves hearing from everyone. If you're safe, give us a call. We want to hear from you. Tell us about your Tropical Storm Helene experiences. I know we save these for the wind-down section, and we're trying to not to get too wound up, but we'd love to hear from you with how you handled Tropical Storm Helene at 803-563-7169. Let us know. We are interested in hearing how this affected everyone. It was a record storm for the state that you're about to learn about right now. A note before we start, folks. This is breaking. This is new. This is happening on Friday. The South Carolina Election Commission has extended its voter registration deadline to October 14th, this following Tropical Storm Helene's impact to the state. This decision was made by a Richland County judge that came following a lawsuit filed by the state Democratic Party. More information can be found at scvotes.gov. It has been a wild 7 days in South Carolina, and even more so in western North Carolina following the massive impacts of Helene, which made landfall in the Florida's Big Bend region as a Category 4 hurricane, and then hit our state as a tropical storm, which brought those strong, sustained winds, powerful gusts, and more than 20 tornadoes. The result was heavy destruction, primarily in the western portion of the state. We're talking Aiken up to Columbia and west of there to the upstate. I spent several days this week traveling, surveying the widespread damage, talking with South Carolinians and state officials about the deadliest storm in our state's modern history. Yes, that even includes 1989's Hurricane Hugo, but it's not appearing to be as destructive, though that's not for a lack of trying. It was the wind this time that caused the most damage. While torrential rains did soak the state, they didn't lead to the kind of flooding that we saw when Hurricane Florence sat over the Carolinas in 2018, or the thousand-year flood that decimated the Midlands in 2015, 9 years ago this week. We have more on that later in the podcast, don't worry. Now, I put this package together for this week in South Carolina, so if you want to see the visual version of this, watch on YouTube, watch on Friday nights at 7:30. But that being said, I wanted to share my reporting with you here as well. So starting us off is South Carolina Emergency Information Network meteorologist Tim Miller giving us a bit of an overview of the storm's impacts.
We've seen some just devastating pictures of the flooding in South Carolina, North Carolina, parts of Tennessee. But for our state, it has been tremendous, and as well as our friends in North Carolina. This is a loop that takes us into Thursday when the storm was off the coast of Florida, making landfall in Taylor County, Florida. This is again Thursday night. Then by Friday, all of this moisture shifts into Georgia and in Carolina, where it's still through Georgia. It was a mighty powerful storm. Now, bear in mind, we had lots of rain before Helene, and then Helene comes in and gives us all this moisture. As the moisture moves up the mountains, it acts like a sponge, and all of the moisture is basically like a rag wringing out of that particular storm cells that move on through, and that's what created tremendous amounts of rain, where we received over 20 inches of rain north of Asheville. And several inches of 20 inches of rain gives us literally trillions of gallons of water falling from the sky. So this is what caused major flooding for parts of the upstate and then certainly into parts of North Carolina. The problem is also the rain that falls towards the north goes through the watershed through South Carolina. So everywhere from the Broad River to the Congaree River to the Saluda to the Watery, all have to take in what falls from up north, then brings it on down towards the ocean. This is a tremendous amount of rain to deal with in a short period of time. Now, let's look at power outages. As of the last 16 hours, still much of the state dealing with some issues, especially the western part of the state and towards the upstate, with some counties still over at 75% dealing without power. This will continue to change, of course, as we move through time, as the power crews are working diligently to get the power back. So this has indeed been a record storm, and it's one that will go down in the history books.
Like I said, I spent several days traveling the state in my trusty Dodge Durango, which did manage to get a nail in a tire, and I think the rear spoiler flew off on the interstate, so apologies. Luckily, there is just a slow leak in that tire, and we survived. But while driving around, I was listening to a lot of terrestrial radio. A, because radio is a great lifeline during these times, especially those informative daily press conferences aired by South Carolina Public Radio. You know, those pressers with the governor and state officials. But B, cell phone service was spotty, so no point in streaming anything. And three, I love radio, especially public radio. But I was also listening to a lot of the commercial radio because, you know, I love a little country music here and there. But it's just good to hear what people are talking about, hear what the radio hosts are talking about. There are really a lifeline, a lot of call-in shows hearing from folks. And here's a sample of what folks were talking about on 99.9 FM Kiss Country.
Somebody must have called in and asked for this because I think it's the right thing. Like
we have had so many phone calls of people going, I don't know what day it is. I'm trying to label stuff in my cabinet so I don't eat bad things.
Right.
And I have no idea what today's date is.
Wednesday, October the 2nd.
Yes. And you know what? Whoever you were that called in, please do not feel like you were alone because it still feels like Thursday of last week. Wow.
It's wild to believe it's been 7 days, hasn't it?
Tomorrow we'll make seven days.
7 days since we arrived at this radio station ready to cover this thing. And we thought,
we really did.
It never happens to us. Well, we'll be home by Saturday.
I think the biggest problem all of us are facing and trying to wrap our mind around is just what we're seeing, what is happening, and the things that we are experiencing. These are things that we never thought we would experience. We've seen it on the news. Mark, Tank, we have reported on this. We've had drives for food, for money, supplies. And to be on this end of it, all of us, it's a hard thing to wrap your mind around. So don't feel bad that you feel bad. Don't feel bad that you're confused. Don't feel bad that you're angry, that you're frustrated. Those are all normal feelings.
Justifiable.
Yeah, and it may be that you're way back up in some holler and you think that you have been forgotten about, that nobody cares. That is not the case.
Chainsaws and power generators made up the soundtrack of life for some in the upstate region following the aftermath of our state's deadliest storm in modern memory. Power companies relied on thousands of local and out-of-state linemen from as far as Canada and Texas to help with restoration efforts after 1.3 million homes went dark due to those powerful winds hitting parts of the state not used to such wind speeds. Crews were climbing up and chopping up massive trees in backyards, as well as some that blocked roads, and took out power lines with them to boot. A complete mess. Without power, it was difficult early in the response to obtain gasoline from North Augusta to the upstate, down even into Lexington County. And when there was power, lines were long and supplies were limited. It's called patience, folks. You gotta pack that. I caught up with Gage Brown of Brown's Tree Service and Stump Removal outside of Inman Intermediate School, where he and his crew were chopping up a massive tree that had fallen on the property. Brown is a Campobello native and summed up what the past few days were like.
We ain't seen nothing like this around here in a while.
And what have you been doing? What's it been like the past couple days?
Non-stop, no sleep, hardly any eating. Trying to find some gas to keep the wheels rolling, but we out here.
And what's it been like? I mean, are you cutting down trees on houses? What have you been seeing?
On houses, blocking driveways. Right now we're helping out District Spartanburg School District 1. We was at the district office yesterday getting some out of the parking lot. Now we're cleaning this up. We was at Inman Elementary this morning off the playground, just doing our part.
And Gage, do you have power at home? What's your home life like
now? No power, cold water, get home, working dark to dark, get home, eat, take a cold shower, get up, repeat.
Dominion Energy South Carolina President Keller Kissam said at the peak, some 436,000 customers were without power in the Dominion Energy system. He gave some perspective at a City of Columbia press conference on Monday.
People talk about Hurricane Hugo. It also was a Category 4. So what we had to do is get the helicopters in the air. We couldn't do that on Friday because the wind speeds were going too much. So we actually had 2 days. We had Saturday, we had Sunday, and then today. 3 days. Hurricane Hugo took us 18 days to have restoration. That won't be the case here, but just give you a comparison, we've had more transmission lines out in the state with Helene than we did with Hugo, to give you the magnitude. So we have to patrol. Once we patrol, we put the saw on the bottom of the copter. It goes out there and it cuts and gets these trees off the transmission. Then once you restore, and that's why people say, I didn't see any crews in my neighborhood. That's because they got to work the transmission. Then we got to work the substations, those fenced-in areas in your neighborhood that reduce the voltage to get to your home.
The massive power loss also led to food supply losses across the area. We're talking refrigerators and freezers of food at home, at grocery stores and restaurants. Poof. While some tried their best with massive supplies of ice, I did see one restaurant owner wheeling in bags of ice up in Spartanburg, or generators, heck, even vehicles running home appliances. Well, that wasn't always going to save everybody. But when stores came back online, supplies again were limited, and many stores only accepted cash. I saw that at Dollar General, at Ingles. Cash is king, baby. Now, folks may do and clean out their pantries, including Jeannie Zawelski in a Spartanburg neighborhood where I met her Tuesday afternoon as she was cooking a frozen pizza on a makeshift grill stove. One of those big solo fire pit type barrel things. Yeah, she made a little makeshift grill on top of that. So, of course, I had to stop and chat.
No, I'm just peeking at the underneath. It's whoa, she's cooking. She's getting there. My boyfriend is Venezuelan, so and my neighbor had this amazing grill, so we've been fine. We had soup, we had arepas, we did hamburgers. I'm trying to cook the last of my freezer right now, which is these freezer pizzas. I don't know how well that's gonna go on the grill, but it's worth a try. It was pretty terrifying. You know, every time I came out, there were more trees on the ground. The wind was just whipping around, and we just sort of sheltered and watched the trees move and tried to guess which one was going to go next. We had a couple houses on the block get hit, but mine's good. I lost a tree in the backyard. We had a lot of trees in the road. That was by far, you know, the bigger priority.
Now, I hope Jeannie's listening. I told her about the pod. She admitted that she doesn't really follow the news much. Welcome, you're in good company. And she said that she found out about the coming storm from a friend. Now, also in the neighborhood, which saw big trees down and some home damage, was Lisa Francis, who told me about her experience.
We've been without power since Friday. It's really bad on this end. We can't charge our phones. We can't call the doctor. We can't get medication. We can't get food. No one has come to check on us. No one has come to see, even if we needed help. And I think it's really bad. This is the first time that we've seen crews, and we are hopeful that the lights will be back on by this weekend or even in a couple of days, because we really don't know how much longer we will be able to take this. Mm-hmm. We were just told that we might have some storms, but we were not prepared for anything like this. It was a little bit chaotic because we didn't know what was going on. We thought it was just a rainstorm coming through, and to see all the trees and stuff down is bad. And not only that, but last month we had a storm and the tree was on top of my house last month. So now this month again. So that's another issue.
From Spartanburg on Tuesday, I set out for Greenwood on Wednesday on my way up to Greenville for President Joe Biden's arrival. Greenwood was also hit hard, and while walking through the neighborhoods, I was gobsmacked by the big trees and home damage, including one massive tree that was resting on Walter Holloway's garage. I met him in his front yard with his dog.
Like I said, it happened around 5 o'clock Friday morning. High wind started blowing, knocked out the transformers. That was the first thing we noticed, the transformer blew out. They had all the sparks and everything from it. Stepped out the door to trying to see what was going on. We heard that loud noise when the tree fell. Couldn't see anything. The rain was coming out sideways. I mean, it was just like, you know, right in front of your face. Once it let up a little bit, we tried to get out of the house again and just try to get away from here. That's why we drove to the Walmart parking lot. When it got daylight, we came back and seen the damage. The damage is pretty well tremendous. We got a tree lies in the house. We got to get it cut off top. We got damage to garage. Everything inside the garage is, you know, pretty well damaged. Hit the edge of the living room. So we having to live pretty well, basically in the second side of the house for now.
I got Greenwood Mayor Brandon Smith on Zoom Thursday morning for his perspective on what happened to his city and how the recovery efforts had been going.
It's truly remarkable that we only lost one life in Greenwood. I mean, I feel like Greenwood, I know there's other hard hit communities and we're praying for them, and especially Western North Carolina. But man, Greenwood seems to have been the epicenter in terms of property damage. It is unbelievable to me how much has been accomplished in the last 6 days in terms of clearing roadways. I mean, every road now is passable. I think we have maybe, basically you can get wherever you need to go. There may be one or two roads where there's still a tree blocking the road, but those people have access out another way. I think just the sheer amount of property damage, the magnitude of the cleanup, I think for me, it's daunting just thinking about what needs to be done. But the cooperation that we've had from a county and a city and a state level and all the nonprofits, the religious community, because you wake up and you go, how are we ever going to clean up? But, you know, you got to put your big boy pants on and get out there and get to work.
Mayon Schechter was down in Aiken on Wednesday surveying the damage. Power officials said more than 1,900 utility poles had snapped because of the storm. A lot of high winds rolled through that area. And Mayon spoke with Salvation Army Captain Michael Good about their support efforts and the need they continue to see.
So when the storm hit on Thursday night, we had already begun prepping for the storm. We pulled in mercy cots at our shelter, went ahead and got some mercy meals, thinking like it was going to be very quick. And what we realized, obviously, on Friday morning was that the devastation was a lot bigger than what everyone originally thought. And so the Salvation Army had access to food almost immediately, and by lunchtime had already served the first 500 meals to families who either had very damaged homes, everyone was without power, and that number has only grown. By the end of today, we're looking at being at right at 9,000 meals served to the community. Again, not thinking, we all thought we would wake up to a couple of tree branches and not entire trees on houses and cars literally split in half and power out from 95% of the city and almost 100% of the county. So that morning, the morning of the 27th, so the hurricane hit 3 a.m. By 7:30 a.m., we were serving breakfast. So the locations are growing. The further out we go, our teams will come back with 2 to 3 more areas that need help. We are hearing about places where CNAs have stayed or doctors have stayed. And just a second ago, found out that there's another place where nurses are kind of just stuck as is. And so trying to figure out how we can take food to them. It's just been a constant where the need is continuously growing.
That same day on Wednesday, President Biden landed at Greenville-Spartanburg Airport on his way to tour devastation in the heavy-hit western North Carolina region. When he deplaned Air Force One, he met Governor Henry McMaster, Senator Lindsey Graham, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, Greenville Mayor Knox White, Spartanburg Mayor Jerome Rice, and Asheville Mayor Esther Mannheimer. But here is Governor McMaster at a press conference later that day recounting his conversation with the president.
The president promised whatever we needed, he would provide. So did FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell. And we spoke to him about the struggles that we're having about the energy. And we asked for the emergency energy declaration, that he signed and granted just 2 days ago. It includes 13 counties. There are 7 more counties that need to be added to that. And as soon as we receive that information, and we're asking and seeking, as soon as we receive that information, those counties, that will include all the counties that have been hit, will be available for the assistance from FEMA. But we explained to the president that we needed that declaration. He agreed that it would be forthcoming. We explained that our farmers have been hit hard. There's no crop insurance for most of the things we produce. Cotton and soybean have crop insurance. But other things like pecans, peaches, and all your livestock, chickens, poultry, all of that sort of thing are not covered at all. So we've asked the president to consider putting that in as an appropriation this time, and the congressman and the senator have agreed that they will work on that as well.
Senator Graham also had this to say about the federal response and meeting with Biden.
So to President Biden, thank you for coming. Thank you for paying attention to our needs. I think we've had good working relationship between the federal government. We talked about the supplemental. We're talking hundreds of billions of dollars to make this part of the country whole. I mean, their people have lost everything. And we got a lot of backfilling to do. And I promised that I would work with President Biden as soon as we can. And I think we should go back in session, quite frankly. I think we need to get back in Washington and deal with this crisis in a responsible way. But we're looking at well north of $100 billion, a lot more than that when it's all said and done.
Following their meeting with the president, McMaster, Graham, and other officials toured a temporary medical shelter that sprung up in Greenville on the concourse of the Bon Secours Wellness Arena, one of eight such shelters across the state. At a press conference Wednesday, Department of Public Health Director Dr. Ed Simmer said the need is there.
This is a medical needs shelter, and these are designed for people who have medical needs. Perhaps they have medical equipment, they have an oxygen generator, but they have medical needs that require a constant supply of electricity. You'll also see there's some folks here in hospital beds, because that's what they need. So for folks whose power is out and they can't, you know, get the medical needs they need at home, they can come here, and we will help them with that. We will take care of them and make sure that they are well. This facility that you're in right now has a capacity of 110 people with medical needs, and 110 caregivers, so they can bring someone with them. Right now we're at about half of that because thankfully the power is starting to come back on and we're able to start getting people to go back home. But we will be here as long as they need us.
And in the middle of all this, let's throw in a dock worker strike. That's right. On October 1st, some 45,000 dock workers along the East and Gulf Coast went on strike. With critical ports shut down, officials like Senator Graham called upon the president and others to fix the situation that threatened Helene recovery efforts.
I can't emphasize this strike needs to end sooner rather than later. I cannot tell you how serious this will jeopardize our recovery in South Carolina and North Carolina. This is going to jeopardize public health. It's going to jeopardize public safety. I understand trying to get a better deal. I get all of that. But there's a federal law on the books that allows the President of the United States to stop and enjoin strikes like this that can affect the public good and the public welfare. I'm here to tell you, I know a lot about our port. It is the economic engine of the state of South Carolina. BMW, a lot of the cars they make here go through that port. They're eventually going to run out of places to put cars. Hospitals. There are a lot of medicines that have been lost because they can't be refrigerated. The supplies will dwindle over time, and this port is an essential outlet to the world for South Carolina. So, President Biden, thank you for what you've done. Thank you for your team. But I am urging you, I am telling you, I am begging you, end this strike sooner rather than later because you're adding misery to pain.
The three-day strike ended Thursday following a temporary agreement by the International Longshoremen's Association, the union representing those striking workers, including those at the Port of Charleston, and the U.S. Maritime Alliance, which represents ports and shipping companies. Now, the strike has been suspended till January unless the two groups can agree to new contract terms, including pay raises and settling disputes over the automation of some tasks at ports that threaten jobs. But back in the wild of South Carolina, I came across Presbyterian College in Clinton. I have never been there on that beautiful campus before, and I will have to go back once the massive oak trees that fell are cleaned up. Now, while getting B-roll and shooting my stand-ups, I ran into college president Dr. Anita Gustafson, who told me about how the college handled the storm.
Was unprecedented, and luckily it came early enough in the morning that students were, you know, in their dorm rooms. It rolled through town. We lost power at 6 a.m. on Friday, and then the storm just kind of ramped up, and I was at the president's house, and we could hear, my family and I could hear some of the big trees going over, so it was very frightening. About 11 o'clock, everybody was kind of coming out and looking pretty much in shock at the damage of the campus. We lost 39 large oak trees. The day it happened, a number of the campus leaders who live near here, and we were walking around trying to find everybody, because we started with having communication at the beginning of the day as the storm came on, and then the communication just, our phones did not work, our texts did not work. That was really hard because a lot of parents couldn't connect with their students. By the end of the day, we heard about some hot spots around Clinton and Lawrence. So we were going to the leadership, we were going into parking lots to find little hotspots so we could get out emails to the larger faculty and staff and to the students and their parents. We're making progress clearing, and so it'll once again look, maybe we will have fewer trees, but it'll look great. And we're having homecoming in about 3 weeks, and we're going to be ready for it.
The 9-year anniversary of the 1,000-year flood that rocked the Midlands, specifically the city of Columbia, was this week. Residents here were clearly on edge, and those memories were actually still fresh in their minds as the Congaree River overspilled its banks, cresting at 30.58 feet. Here is City of Columbia City Manager Teresa Wilson comparing Helene to 2015.
Between 2015 and today, mass flooding and the threat to our main drinking water source were critical issues in 2015. That is not the case today. So we are in a much better place from that regard as far as, you know, having built the build back, I would call it, and the use of partnerships with our federal delegation members who've worked very hard, a shout out to them, to keep this on the forefront. You know, Congressman Clyburn and Graham, and all the others have recognized the need for us to build back up our system even better to serve our school districts, our, you know, universities, flagship university, and of course, the trauma centers here in Columbia. So I would say for me, that's the answer from the standpoint of the previous flood to now, is having better infrastructure and resources in place.
Clint Sheely, Assistant City Manager of Columbia Water, also spoke about the differences in the water system since the flood of 2015, which breached the Columbia Canal.
This situation is, again, very different than 2015, although the river level is approaching what we saw in 2015. We had flow coming over land from the city, from the heavy rains, flowing directly into the canal. We didn't have the control over the head gates that we have. In every tropical storm media briefing that you've seen me at over the last 9 years, you've heard me talk about this interim but very robust solution of a rock dam that is in place in our canal itself. All those tools are still in place, and again, they're operating as intended, and things are working like they're supposed to. If anything were different, we would be letting you know. I assure you, we will be transparent, and we'll let you know the moment we know that something is different. Right now, everything is operating as intended, and we don't anticipate anything different. We have lost power at some of our water pumping stations out in the distribution system, and we're working with Dominion Energy and our partners at the co-op that supply power to those to get those back online power. We had generators in place or either pulled generators to those sites so that our customers never knew the difference in terms of pressure and supply. This river level event will probably be the 7th or 8th highest in history. For context, 2015 was the 6th highest. And so those bridges are designed to withstand these types of flooding events.
The Congaree River level was something to see, very muddy, very spooky, but there were no problems in the city or with the water, despite rampant misinformation on social media. Y'all, please stop believing that stuff you cause panic and fear when officials are clearly saying there's no problem here. I know you guys don't because you listen to the pod, you're smart people, but here is Teresa Wilson again talking about some of the nonsense people were spreading.
And even since we're in here, we're continuing to get communications via social media or otherwise. One in particular that I continue to get, I just got a text from a friend who works at Congaree Wastewater Plant, which is not what it's called actually, and they just evacuated staff in expectations that the plant and the one on the Broad River 2 will be flooded today. So fill up your bathtubs. We may lose water, wastewater access for a while. Distruth, falsity. We have said it here today. I'm just reiterating it because it keeps coming. There are no evacuations. Our workers, wastewater treatment staff, who are doing a yeoman's job, are doing that job at the plant as their rising river levels around them. So everything ACM Simons just explained is where we are, and we are in good shape. They're doing a great job. No one's being evacuated.
Official news sources only, folks. That goes for natural disasters. That goes for the election. That goes for everything. Okay? Did Springfield, Ohio teach us nothing about misinformation? The dogs, the cats, the pets. Anyhow, that's my report for a week after Helene. You can find it and so much more on SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. What you're not going to find here, though, is a wind down because we have gone over our own riverbanks here, if you will, if you'll let me have that. But we love hearing from you, and we will have a wind down next week. So give us a voicemail that we can use to talk about in the wind down. Talk to us about your Tropical Storm Helene experiences at 803-563-7169. You can stay up to date with the latest news on SCETV.org and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org, and don't forget to support your local newspapers. The South Carolina Lead is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Amy Crouch is our supervising producer. Sean Birch is our executive producer. This podcast is produced with support from PRX and is made possible in part by a grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, as well as listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. For the South Carolina Lead, I'm Gavin Jackson. Be well, South Carolina. A spoon when all you need is a fork. Sorry, you and I were just riffing. We're just doing a little Alanis Morissette riff.